Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz, Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die. NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Hello, good morning, everyone. This is Saturday, and right now I'm in Hagerstown, Maryland. Dr. Paul Alexander, Dr. Paul Elias Alexander, and I've been asked to come and speak with the U.S. truckers. I began by the Mojave Desert there in Adelanto, California, about 2 weeks ago with them after I came from the Ottawa trucker convoy, and which you probably would remember the week before that I spoke at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial about ending these vaccine mandates. So the convoy has stopped in Hagerstown and is going to roll, I believe, later today or tomorrow on the outskirts of the D.C. Beltway and potentially end in Virginia. They will not be entering D.C. because everyone in the know has told them, because, you know, you can't control the behavior of everybody, and we want no trucker entering D.C. With not the most pristine behavior. And because we can't control individual people, and there are thousands of truckers in this convoy now, we've made the decision. I'm not a leader. I'm just a scientist speaking, but I've been in meetings where I've listened to the leaders speak, and they've commanded all of these truckers, do not enter Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., because of the State of the Union, which you know, all of the governments, all 435 Congress, all 100 senators, the SCOTUS, president, vice president, speaker, everyone is in the central government in that location. So it's a very militarized zone right now, rightly so, very heavily protected. So if you go down into Washington, you go close to the mall, and you as even jump the wrong way, you're going to be in some trouble. We don't want the truckers down there. So we've commanded them, do not. And if they do, I am saying here openly, the People's Convoy, then they will not be connected to this convoy in any way. So I'm here, I'm talking to science, basically, that the vaccine mandates must come down. In fact, all mandates, immediate. Well, maybe 6 months ago, a year ago. Particularly the emergency powers that underpin them. The science is clear. The vaccines failed on the Delta variant and has failed completely on Omicron. The vaccines do not properly protect the upper airways. It does not sterilize the virus. And I'm not getting too much into the immunology, but that really means that it does not stop you, the vaccinee, from becoming infected, replicating virus, or even transmitting. So I mean, common sense will tell you, if the purpose of the vaccine is to stop transmission, et cetera, to get the population level immunity, to stop, to cut the chain of transmission, then why would I be taking a vaccine, or you mandate a vaccine under penalty to lose my job, lose my income, et cetera? If it doesn't work, it does not do the key issue. It does not stop transmission. Therefore, the vaccines have failed. So right now, there's no science to support these mandates. These truckers had a good gut instinct and common sense. My role, having been invited to the Canadian trucker convoy to speak, now the U.S. convoys, is to tell them, look, it's not just common sense on your part. And truckers rule this world. The truckers are the key. The truckers run this economy. And my role is to tell them, look, I'm on your side because you have 100% of the science. Don't just come out there and have people taking shots at you saying, oh, what did you just these disgruntled truckers? No. The truckers are actually waging the battle that the scientists and the doctors and the government should have. So the population was failed by everyone involved. The truckers actually are waging the battle they should have. So I'm here, and I want to introduce a very good friend I consider a brother, Alex Holstein. And he's an expert in political affairs, and his background training and his science is so adept. And this Russia-Ukraine issue, I mean, it's beyond. Look, I can speak from my own personal reading and acumen over the years. I mean, of course, I have a little politics inside of me, but I'm no way in Alex's wheelhouse. I don't think anyone is. That's why I wanted him to put out a little video to introduce himself here and for you to understand his perspective. So let me allow Alex to introduce himself. You talk a little bit more about COVID, and then Alex will have the floor to give his assessment of how we got here with this Ukraine issue, Ukraine-Russia, and how he thinks we should get out of it. Over to you, Alex.
Hi there, Paul. How you doing? Where are you at right now, in Maryland?
Yes,
Hagerstown, right Maryland. The capital? All right. Well, there you go. Well, it's great to be here. My background is in Russian and post-Soviet studies. I got my master's at the London School of Economics in Russian and post-Soviet studies. That's actually on the degree. It takes up a lot of space. I did my thesis on the Soviet KGB. I wrote about the power and ascendance of the KGB during the Gorbachev, from the Brezhnev to the Gorbachev era, which if you track that ascendance, continued past the downfall and dissolution of the Soviet Union and the rise of the Yeltsin administration, and throughout the Yeltsin administration, culminating in the rise of Vladimir Putin, who accrued a lot of power behind the curtain. And I've been studying him since that time when he was known as the Gray Cardinal in the Kremlin, who's the real power behind the curtain of the Yeltsin administration towards the end, took over on Chechnya, was head of the FSB, which was one of the takeover intelligence agencies, one of the old branches off the KGB tree when it was split up, and ended up as president. And so if you study that, you find that there's this ascendance right to where we are today in regard to who controls the power in Russia, which is a cadre of former intelligence service and current intelligence service, security service officers. They're known as the Siloviki now. They're the people of force is what that means. And they've completely consolidated their power in the Kremlin, and they see the West through a very particular lens, much of it honed, particularly in the KGB, which had its own institutional culture, which I would refer to as Czechism. They would refer to it as that too. They used to be known as Czechist or Czechisti. That comes from the name of the first KGB, which was called the Cheka, which was the first KGB organized after the Bolshevik Revolution. The KGB went through many different variations throughout the Soviet period. And at the end, it was known as the KGB from about 1954 through the end of the Soviet Union. It was known as the KGB. And the Czechisti sort of developed their own institutional ideology and brotherhood that even superseded and supplanted communism as communism deteriorated. And I like to say that it became a sort of escape pod from the communist mothership when that went down with the Soviet Union. So the Czechisti were able to stick together, and they bonded with the other intelligence services like the GRU, which is Russian military intelligence, or with Soviet military intelligence. Mm-hmm. And they formed this sort of, well, brotherhood or bratva, and like almost like an organized crime organization, except a very powerful one, a very slick one, a very adept one, very politically adept. And they were able to maneuver, with Vladimir Putin, under Vladimir Putin's leadership, and consolidate their power. Their main rival, just to give you a little more background, their main rival in Russia were known as technocrats, the technokrati, which was basically symbolized by the time Putin did that sort of switcheroo with Medvedev about 2008. Mm-hmm. Was
but he became prime minister,
right? And he was, yes. And Medvedev was a technocrat. And what Putin did there was very crafty, because what he did was he didn't put another Silovik, another security man, in his place, because he had to leave the presidency in order to come back and be president again. And he didn't want a placeholder who was going to be competition from within his own cadre. So he did a sort of double take out of that. He basically was able to, on the one hand, keep a Silovik out of power who might be competition for him and not let him back into the presidency. And then at the same time, co-opt the technocrats finally. And that basically symbolized the end of the technocrats being any sort of competition for Vladimir Putin. Doesn't mean they can't be again, but Medvedev was definitely in his pocket as the head technocrat. And that was the end of that. So Putin's been in full control, full steam control since then. And it's since then that you see him starting to really assert and reassert Russian strength within what they consider their traditional sphere of influence, culminating in his activities in Ukraine, which we see now, unfortunately, which is, and let me just say, some of the things we're going to talk about, I don't want this to come off as some sort of defense of Vladimir Putin or what he's done or his type of government. He's a
kleptocrat. Myself.
Yeah, exactly. He's a dictator. He's a corrupt, yes, kleptocrat. What he's done in Ukraine is awful. It's evil and abhorrent. And the world needs to take heed of it and to do something about it. And that's what we're going to talk about. But at the same time, it was very much the writing on the wall for many years, all on the Kremlin wall, at least, because and I think one of the reasons we ended up here was in Western circles, in Western foreign policy circles, was we completely ignored and dismissed the, I don't want to say threat, but the sort of looming resurgence of Russian power on the horizon that was occurring. And we also ignored and dismissed the Russian perspective within our own calculus of NATO expansion. Look, when I was back at the LSE, and this was a long time ago, I won't say how long, Yeltsin administration, there was a question on our final exam on Soviet and post-Soviet foreign policy about NATO expansion. I don't remember exactly how it was phrased, but we spent a lot of time discussing NATO expansion even then during the Yeltsin period. And it was, we dig deep. And this was before they had taken in all the Eastern European states, before certainly they had taken in the Baltics, the former Soviet republics, the Baltics or Moldova. So we were deciding, is this a good idea? And my answer to it always was, whether in class or on that exam, was it's got to be an all or nothing prospect. Either we go all the way and take Russia into the fold as well, in a phased.
You mean into NATO?
Into NATO. Either go all the way in a phased approach, you know, just like they've done it, phased, but always with the end goal being Russia will be the crown jewel. Russia will come in. Gorbachev threw it out there. I think it was to Secretary of State James Baker shortly, either as the Soviet Union was dissolving or shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. What if the Soviet Union joined NATO? I think it was after the Warsaw Pact collapsed, but the Soviet Union was still around. And Baker said, that's a dream. And then later, Putin claims that he said it to Clinton late in the Clinton administration, that Putin had said to President Bill Clinton, brought up NATO expansion with Russia. What if Russia joined NATO? And Clinton, I think, according to Putin, he wouldn't quote him exactly, but he said basically he said that Bill Clinton kind of blew it off, was basically how that went. I think it would have been a great idea to put that out there as a carrot for the Russians, that, hey, we're all in this together. We believe in the indivisibility of security, which is a term they use quite often, somewhat cynically right now, as they, you know, they talk about the indivisible security of European states. And then, of course, they're invading a European state right now. So, I mean, it's a little bit hypocritical, as Russians can be in their government. But the fact of the matter is that I think it would have been much more, we would have had a much more peaceful prospect into our future and today had we considered Russian membership in NATO and looked at this as an all or nothing thing, because otherwise they're being left on the bench and they're feeling like, okay, well, geostrategically, geopolitically, and historically, we've never liked anyone encroaching on our borders. And what we see is NATO, yes, a defensive alliance, but a defensive alliance that's edging right along our borders. And Ukraine was the last straw. You know, going after the former Soviet republics was always controversial, but Ukraine was the last straw. And you consider the cultural ties, the historic ties. This is the site of the Kievan Rus, where Russians believe their country was first formed. It's a big part of their national identity. Of course, you know, that can be used very cynically in pursuing realpolitik and geopolitical objectives, which are, I think, the main thrust right here. But those geopolitical and realpolitik objectives also have validity. And even if you don't agree with the perspective, even if you think it's everything that Vladimir Putin says is illegitimate, we classify it in the Western press as crazy and rambling, his speech about why he was going in Ukraine. I watched the speech. I don't think it was crazy and rambling. I think there were illegitimate arguments made, but he made them very clinically and coldly. But you know, that's their perspective. And when you're dealing with foreign policy, you have to take that into account. You absolutely must weigh that.
I think, you know, I want to unpack that in this segment where you explain how we got here. And I think key for the world, and listen, I look at you as a global leader in the sense that you could probably say things in a way that serious people, very serious, important people right now, decision makers, could listen to. That's why I wanted to stop this COVID discussion bluntly and just try and get this out to a lot of my people that subscribe to me and stuff. And they have a couple of shows that I want to see if I could get you into War Room with Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson, because I consider these people to be serious people. And I think you were having a discussion with me recently where I think it was so fascinating because, in other words, the way I understood what you were explaining, which I kind of looked at it so, but not the way you had unpacked it to me, but what you're saying is with the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russians and people like Vladimir Putin, the KGB, always lived in almost a paranoid, suspect world where they viewed the entire world that way, and where the West and with the greatest nation on earth, the United States, I have to say that, erred and stumbled and hobbled themselves, is they did not take in their calculus the paranoia of Putin and KGB, etc., into account and how they view how Putin would be seeing their moves to expand NATO. So that's what I want to discuss.
That's exactly right. I mean, and the way they view in this Czechisti view of the world is that America, they call it the main enemy. They've been doing that since the Soviet times. America and NATO are the main enemy. They still use that lexicon. That's the KGB in-house lexicon. They still use it in the wall, within the walls of the Kremlin today, within the halls of the Kremlin today. If you're walking through the Kremlin and you're talking about America, you're talking about NATO, you're probably calling it the main enemy if you're a former KGB officer like Vladimir Putin. And I've been saying this for years whenever I've been in, you know, I worked for the Republican Party. We discuss foreign policy issues. Just in conversations at dinners, I bring it up. And people would, you know, kind of roll their eyes and go, ah, the Cold War's over. This was, you know, in the mid-2000s, and Putin was really starting to, it looked like to me, starting to behave like a KGB man. I have to give Tom Brokaw credit. He said the other day, I think he was being interviewed on his old network, NBC or wherever, and he said, you know, he interviewed Vladimir Putin about 20 years ago, and he said he was the he hasn't changed, because everyone's saying he's changed. You know, Condi Rice is saying he's changed. Tom Brokaw was saying he hasn't changed. He was a KGB man when I interviewed him, and he's a KGB man now. That's very poignant. He's absolutely right. And that goes to that mindset and that clouded lens, that prism, that distorted prism through which the KGB view the United States and view the West. And when we play into that paranoia by encroaching up to their borders and teasing the idea of Ukrainian membership in the EU and teasing the idea of Ukrainian membership in NATO, we were playing with nuclear fire because we were playing into that paranoia. It also gave Vladimir Putin at home the ability to play up Russian fears, traditional Russian fears about Western encroachment. And
yes.
So, you know, it was very much mishandled. I never thought that, short of inviting the Russians into NATO, I never thought we could be full allies with the Russians, simply because of the way they their distorted view of us. You know,
yes.
It's not that it's not that they're right, we're wrong. It's that they just have this distorted view that we didn't take into account and we didn't give enough weight. And we also removed respect from the equation too. We were very disrespectful in many of our relations with the Russians, very dismissive. That's not, whether you think they deserve the respect or not, and right now they don't deserve a lot of respect for what they're doing in Ukraine, which is terrible and brutal and awful.
Vicious, terrible.
Vicious. But whether you respect them or not, during our relationship, and I'm just doing the hot wash now on the last 20 years of Putin's years in our foreign policy with him, we were very dismissive of them. Even in our compliments, there was a tone of condescension. We're still the superpower, you're not. And yet they had the same 4,000 nuclear warheads pointed at us, and they were slowly but surely modernizing those warheads and their army too, their military as well. So, you know, this lack of respect, I think Putin's biggest probably moment in turning that around was when he introduced his military pretty much full force in a very American kind of way into the Middle East, into Syria, and said,
yes.
Here I am now. You're not the only superpower on the block anymore. My guys can go all over the world and forward project Russian power, just like America does. And I think that's the way, I'm not saying that's accurate in his view. I'm just saying that's his view. That's how he would see that. Now we're standing toe to toe with the United States. Now let them hear us.
But before I just do a little thing quick on COVID, because I wanted to, you know, make sure my views are back out there again constantly and let you finish up with how we get out of this.
Sure.
What do you think? I mean, you know my views on President Trump. And I mean, I wanted to always have a conversation that's not political, but I supported President Trump. I would go on record on saying that if a liberal like a Bob Kerry or a Jim Webb were running, that kind of liberal, the liberal that respects flag, loves country, honors the military, police, etc., I would throw all my weight behind them. But the liberal government that we have today is so left of left. It is hard to wrap my consider. Some of the policies are so extreme and anti-American. That's the key. The key is when I am trying to assess somebody, I assess them, whether in Canada or in America or in India or any country, is when you make statements and you have positions and policies, do those positions benefit the country that you're leading? If they are not, how could I support you? And right now, when I see policy by policy that the present administration is implementing, they do not support, they do not back the American way of life, the American economy. Everything works against and damaging the country. That's the difference I found with Trump. Whether he was successful or not, when he spoke, his policies and stuff supported America. So I'm asking you a blunt question. What do you think, what were the highlights where you think could embody or explain really that? Because it is a fascinating relationship between Trump and Putin.
First of all, I think you made an excellent point about the politics of the country and supporting people like Jim Webb and heroes
yes.
of our country, no matter what, you know, political, you know, you might disagree. I'm an issue to issue guy. I don't get behind personality. I don't like cult of personality. It's certainly something I didn't like about MAGA is the cult of personality sort of involved.
Agree.
I don't like that. I think we should be able to dispense with the people when they've run their course. And I think that's why we have term limits. I like ideas and I like issues. And in fact, I got out of campaign politics to do issue advocacy so I could focus on things that I care about, which include human rights and human rights advocacy, which I've done.
Yes.
And I've been written about in a book called Shadow on the Mountain. My activities are written about. I was able to write a book myself, Warfighter, about Colonel Jesse Johnson, which is coming out May 15th. May 15th, Warfighter,
yes.
The story of an American fighting man about Colonel Jesse Johnson, one of our greatest heroes who's seen 40 years of warfare and knows what kind and has been at the highest levels of decision making and knows what good decision making and bad decision making and what kind of bad decision making leads to things like Vietnam and leads to things like what we're seeing in Ukraine right now. But as far as politics is concerned, I mean, I'm having an interesting conversation. I have a lot of friends who are on the left side of the spectrum, a lot of friends who are on the right side of the spectrum. It's having an interesting conversation with some friends of mine, Canadian friends of mine, who are in the Green Party. And we found ourselves completely on the same page and script about authoritarianism in this world. And it's seeping into the West with
mm-hmm.
what was going on up in Canada with the truckers
yes.
and, you know, how they were being treated in an authoritarian fashion. And I said to my friend, I said, Nick, you sound like a conservative. What happened? Have you had awakening?
Funny.
He said, no. He said, there is no more conservative and liberal. There's only authoritarian and libertarian. And you're either a libertarian who believes in freedom or you're an authoritarian who doesn't.
Yes.
And I thought that was very poignant because I think that's where what we've seen. And that's why you say, well, there's guys in the Democrat Party that I agree with. And then there's guys in the Republican Party or people in the Republican Party that I don't agree with. And we see that now. We see that there's the parties themselves have become bifurcated and polarized. I think that, I mean, as far as the relationship with Putin and Trump, I think it was pretty neutral, to be honest. And President Trump, I mean, I know that, you know, when our forces engaged in Syria with Russian forces, we wiped them off the map. When the Ukrainians needed weapons, he sent them. And which leads me to, you know, the situation today. And I sort of take a middle road position. There's some people who are just eager to just, you know, chomping at the bit to go to war. And there's two things on that. One, they're nuts.
I agree. I am not chomping at my bit for war. Tone this down.
We need to tone it down. But at the same time, what I've been saying for 20 years is Russia is an adversary. The best we can hope for them with them without bringing them into NATO is that we'll be frenemies one day. If we have good diplomacy, we can avoid war and be frenemies with Russia, which means cooperate on the issues where we find common ground and then agree to disagree on issues where we don't, and don't poke the bear in the eye in his own sphere of influence. That's one thing you're going to have to do if you want to be frenemies. You're going to have to restrain yourself from asking Ukraine to be part of EU and NATO. It just is, it's a reality, okay? Again, I'm not saying that they deserve to be invaded. Absolutely not. They're a sovereign nation. They can decide what they want to do. And Putin violated that, and he's violating it in the most brutal and disgusting way possible. But that's the reality. We never work that reality into our calculus. So what do we do now? Well, I believe that on the one hand, on the overt side, we have to be completely strategically diplomatic, and we have to weigh the Russian perspective at all times into our calculus, and also weigh for every decision we make, especially any bold move, we have to realize the nuclear calculus as well and how that's going to play in. So one of the things I suggest, which I think is perfectly legitimate, while I'm against bringing Ukraine or anybody or entertaining the idea, and I don't think anyone will now, EU or NATO. I mean, it's great they signed the application, and I think Zelensky's a brave man, and he's Churchillian in his bravery, but I don't think that they're going to take the EU. I don't think the EU is going to accept that application now. But I do think that Sweden and Finland,
yes,
we should bring them into NATO
yes.
now. Traditional Western-oriented democracies who do not have the cultural historic ties with Russia. They are not former Soviet republics. They are not within the Russian sphere of influence. In fact, quite interestingly, Finland's had a very contentious relationship with Russia through the centuries, particularly in the early 20th century. They were under Tsarist rule. And then in the mid-20th century, they had a war, the Winter War, and fought, availed themselves very bravely against the Soviet forces. So I think it would be a good idea to bring them in. It sends a message to Russia that, okay, if you're going to attack neutral countries, some of those neutral countries that don't have those cultural, historic, or geopolitical ties with you, they are going to come into the NATO fold. And an Article 5 umbrella insurance policy for them is absolutely necessary now, because you've proven you're willing to invade a neutral country, because at the time Ukraine was technically a neutral country when Russia invaded it. So we should take that into account. I think also our intelligence services need to wake up and start, or at least they need to be unleashed. I know a lot of people have been chomping at the bit on brave intelligence service soldiers, our paramilitary operations officers, our clandestine officers in the CIA, the analysts. They've been chomping at the bit to deal with Russia. So now is their chance. We need a joint intelligence task force, Russia House, to go after the Russians wherever they forward project around the world, and play it according to the Moscow rules of the great game of the Cold War era, that what I call the Soviet period of the Cold War, because in my view and in the KGB's view, the Cold War never ended.
Yeah.
It's not Cold War II. This is still Cold War I. It's just the post-Soviet Cold War I, or you could even say post 9/11 from the American perspective, Cold War I. But it is the continuing Cold War, and we're in a new phase of it. And I think that we need to counter them wherever they are and where they forward project in our backyard. The Russians have been forward projecting with impunity in Latin America and Venezuela for years now. Perhaps it's time for Mr. Maduro to go. Perhaps it's time for Mr. Guaido, the true president of Venezuela, to be installed back where he was elected as the interim president. He should be the president of Venezuela, and Venezuela should be in the Western fold. That is our backyard. So they don't want us dealing in their sphere of influence. We don't want them dealing in our sphere of influence. And then we can work on taking Cuba out of their fold, not through force or through any sort of coup d'etat, but through diplomatic relations and rapprochement. We can supply 80% of the food that the Cuban people eat. Our farmers can get paid for that. A lot of Republicans on the Hill who represent the heartland are totally behind Cuban rapprochement, U.S.-Cuban rapprochement. It's one thing I totally agreed with President Obama on, was seeking rapprochement with Cuba. It's a smart move. Take them out of the Russian fold, the Chinese fold, any other fold of people who are hostile to our interests. This is our backyard. So that's another area. Africa. We see a lot of Russian mercenaries operating in South Sudan, in Mozambique, places like that, Libya. We need to counter them there, whatever their activities are. It doesn't mean we have to get, we're kind of like a bull in the global China shop. Sometimes we need to learn there, in the movie Heat, the bank robbers and the cops, they talk about you go in strong, guns blazing, or you go in on the prowl. And we're always running it like we're doing some cowboy score liquor store holdup.
Yeah.
And we should be going in on the prowl. So, we need to, it's not always that we need to take them head on. It's not always that we need to get muscular with them, but sometimes it's just keeping an eye on what they're doing, keeping tabs on everything they're doing, knowing everything the Russians are doing, wherever they are, and making sure they know we know at the times where it pays to do so. So these are the things that we have been slipping on tactically. And I think we need to pour weapons into Ukraine. As much as I think we need to keep out of it as a hot war, I think using the usual great game rules of plausible deniability, just as we did in the Afghan war, okay, the Soviet Afghan war, we Operation Cyclone. I call for an Operation Cyclone 2 in Ukraine. As long as an insurgency occurs there and protracts the war, then we need to be supplying that insurgency and pouring in human assets who still offer us the plausible deniability so that we can run any sort of operations there that we need to in regard to clandestine services. So whether it's spying on Russia itself or engaging in supporting any sort of insurgency. But once martial law comes into play, if Putin does get a puppet state put in place, there will be martial law. And at that point, it becomes a very denied area, very difficult to get into. So we need to get in there now and recruit the necessary assets that we have, a very strong intelligence network. We need to make sure that Vladimir Putin, the expenses for Vladimir Putin are much higher than the benefits. The cost is much higher than the benefit. And that cost sometimes can come out in a very covert way. So, and one of the ways is how we forward project our intelligence gathering and espionage activities and subterfuge against the Russian state right in their backyard. So they didn't want NATO there. Okay, how about the CIA?
Yeah, and the thing, Alex, which I think is, we've gone into this world now where everything is a cancel culture. So on wokeism and stuff, which is so bizarre and insane. And they did it with COVID in the sense that the governments moved in Canada, even some blue states in America and some countries where they wanted doctors to cancel surgeries and care of people who are unvaccinated. Yet the unvaccinated people, and I'm going to draw the parallel to this situation in Russia and Ukraine, the unvaccinated people are the people who were either COVID recovered. They were probably informed enough that they felt, with my own risk profile, I don't need a vaccine, or for whatever reason. And you live in a free society, and particularly with the advent of the Omicron, which is so mild, equal to or less than the flu. So, but yet this cancer culture was seeking to deny care, deny hospital or medical care, and deny privileges and services to people because you are unvaccinated. And it's similar here. I'm seeing people are saying Russian people must not get medical care in the hospital. Things like that. Like, it's gone extreme. It's gone bizarre. And my problem with it is I saw what they did even with President Trump with the election in the end, even Fox. Fox, you would have thought, was even if not neutral, you knew a little more right of center. They turned on him. So I don't know how these people operate. But it seems that they just go where the hip view is at this point. So right now is everything anti-Russia, everything anti-Putin. And nobody, this is why I wanted to talk to you. Look at this conversation we just had and the things that you just said. You have laid out, not even fully unpacking it or unraveling this. You have just skimmed the surface and it demonstrates a much more balance. I'm sure when people listen to what you just said, they've never heard the things you just said. Because now if you turn on the news, any news is this Putin the killer, anti-Russian, you want to blow Russia off the... We can't. I am not in your depth in terms of politics and stuff, but we cannot. We are dealing with a nation that has 4,000 to 5,000 nuclear weapons equal to America. It might even be more advanced in some areas. So we are running into a serious problem if we continue this way. His back is against the wall. You made a statement before to me. How do we make peace while we're at war? And I think it's the most fascinating thing because that is where we are. We have to find a way to work this out. I think the issue here is at the highest levels, not those boys and girls in the State Department who last year were handing out lawn signs for Biden's campaign and now have a job. Because I saw the same thing when I worked in HHS under Trump. I came across 22 and 23-year-old people that when we were at HHS and had a serious COVID issue and we had a policy problem we were dealing with on a day, and we would wind up to the White House. My boss, I would be sitting down in the office, he'd be talking into the, and he couldn't even speak to the president because you have a 23-year-old prior lawn sign person blocking you from speaking to the chief of staff or some, you know what I mean? It's just the most insane. Biden and these people need to get up, talk to the right people fast, talk to Vladimir one-on-one and try to sort this out. Because
well,
the media,
Oh, I was just going to say the two things that you mentioned. I mean, you know, a lot of everything you just mentioned that you said that you're criticizing is based on they're based on emotion, those statements that they're making. And those people are emotionally reacting, which is the worst thing we can do in a foreign policy situation. Doesn't mean you can't have a heart or be humanitarian, but you have to be sober. You have to be coldly rational when weighing calculus, especially in the nuclear context. And as far as people, you know, Lindsey Graham, he calls for regime change in Russia. He says to assassinate Putin. I mean,
he's crazy.
A lot of this, it would be a disaster. We
if
have
we did
no
that.
Idea. He, you know, he may be a devil, but he's the devil we know. And we don't know what devil comes after him. It could be a lot worse. Let me put one thing into perspective here. Russia, and again, not a defense of this regime, not a defense of Vladimir Putin. You just heard me call for a spearhead of CIA operations in Ukraine to mess with the Russians. You just heard me call to remove Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela. You just heard me say, let's go after the Russians wherever they are in the world. But be advised, Russia today, from a sober perspective, is free. The Russian people are freer than they ever have been. The Russian, they have more rights, they have more stability, and they have more prosperity than at any time in their history. Now, I know that's not saying much considering his predecessors, who they were, all back to Stalin and Lenin, and the czars, Ivan the Terrible. And the Russians weigh their leaders according to two categories, Malenkov-Krav and Bolshoi-Krav. Malenkov-Krav is small-scale bloodshed. Bolshoi-Krav is large-scale bloodshed. Putin is definitely Malenkov-Krav. He's even less bloodshed, we'll see after the Ukrainians, situation, but within his own borders, within domestically, he's even less than Yeltsin, who shelled his own parliament and who razed Grozny to the ground and killed tens of thousands of people of his own citizens in Chechnya. Okay. Gorbachev, everybody loves Gorbachev in the West. He does a Pizza Hut commercial, whatever, Pepsi, whatever he did. Gorbachev ordered the unarmed protesters shot by Soviet troops in the late 80s, early 90s in Tbilisi, Georgia, in Baku, Azerbaijan, where they still mourn every Black January, they call it, is when that happened. 127 Azerbaijanis in Baku were shot down, unarmed protesters. Vilnius, 13 people executed who had taken over a radio station to protest Soviet oppression in Vilnius, Lithuania, were executed by Spetsnaz forces under Gorbachev's orders.
And Gorbachev,
He covered up Chernobyl. This is Russia, okay? In relative terms, Putin is very soft in relative terms within the Russian context. Within our context, he's a monster. But within their context, he's very soft, and people have a lot more freedom. It's more the corruption that's oppressing them because it's put all this money into, you know, the very tippity-tip 1% while a lot of people starve. But 180 million Russians are a lot better off today than they were 25 years ago under Yeltsin and certainly 25 years before that under Brezhnev Brezhnev. So, you know, it's progression, and we don't know what we get afterwards. It'd be great if we got somebody who was westernized and had democratic values and was like Zelensky, if we had a Russian Zelensky takeover, that'd be wonderful, but that's not a guarantee. So this idea of decapitating Putin and a Russian regime change is absolutely insane. The other thing that's insane that's happening here, and it's happening from people that, you know, 50 years ago would have been on the flip side of the coin ranting about Vietnam being a mess and being terrible, are the people that are against dissent, the people that are against caution. There is nothing wrong, and there is certainly nothing treasonous with questioning why we are going to war. I just wrote a book about warfare, and the thing I really learned from it, and I was mentored throughout the process by a man named Joe Galloway, who's one of our greatest heroes. We just lost him in August. One of our greatest national treasures was Joe Galloway. He's a reporter for UPI for decades, for 50 years, and he had fought in Vietnam with the 7th Cav at Yadrang. They made a movie about it called We Were Soldiers. He wrote the book, one of the greatest war books ever written, with General Hal Moore, one of our greatest generals. and also wrote a book on the Gulf War. He's been in every war. And the one thing Joe taught me and the one thing Colonel Johnson's own story taught me as I was writing Jesse's story, Colonel Johnson's story, was that you love the warrior, but you hate the warfare. And if you really love the warrior, then you darn well question why we're going into warfare. And Joe always said that we should never go to war after his experience in Vietnam. The only civilian, by the way, awarded a Bronze Star by the United States Army for his actions that day, trying to save the life of a soldier who got hit in a friendly fire napalm attack, Jimmy Nakayama. Joe always said, we should never go to war unless it's absolutely for our own national survival. None of these esoteric, you know, realpolitik reasons for, you know, shaping the global map and the sort of John Bolton neocon,
even neolib.
And neolib, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Hillary Clinton, we got rid of Gaddafi. For what? Now look at Libya. It's
a mess.
Failed state. It's a failed state. And not just Libya. The entire Sahel region is a complete mess. I know people very close to me, I think you know, Paul, who are going there right now to fight again and to hunt our enemies, the terrorists, who we still have to deal with, ISIS. Al-Qaeda, who've metastasized in Africa because of that, what happened in Libya. Can you imagine if we make the same kind of mistake in our calculus regarding Russia? We've already preliminarily done so regarding Ukraine. Can you imagine if we do it regarding Russia with a regime change there? Can you imagine the mess with 4,000 nuclear weapons up for grabs? It's not worth it. Stability is always the better choice in this case.
Yeah, and the thing is, I found under Trump, Putin and Trump had this sort of healthy respect for each other, like two strong men. And I think you know, it might sound bizarre how I'm seeing it, particularly the left and the rhinos and the Trump haters. Their anger towards Putin, they're actually projecting it on him because of the hatred still for Trump. Because when they see Putin, they see Trump. It's a kind of a fascinating thing because you're looking at bold people. Look, I'm not talking about what Putin is doing right now. I have a lot of anger, not anger because I mean it's a lot of rage and stuff, the disappointment and pain from what I'm seeing. I mean, innocent people are dying. And I always find there's another way you could solve a difficulty in this situation. You could solve a problem. You get to sit on, get the right people to sit on, stop the posturing. Stop the CNN and the Fox and the MSNBC inflaming, insulting people, inflaming the situation, want to attack you. Because if you went on to CNN, I'll give you an example. If you went on to CNN today and spoke, if somebody was brave enough, one of those reporters interview you, like a Wolf Blitzer or something, or a Tapper, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
They would savage those interviewers after their careers would be over. Because you are talking balance, you are unpacking the issue, you're trying to come up with solutions, and you're taking a very level-headed. I mean, how would these people not understand that what would happen tomorrow if, let's say, Canada, Trudeau decided that he would let Putin build a military base and install a couple of nuclear weapons on Canadian soil in Niagara Falls? What do you think? What do you think America would do? America would just sit back and say, "Okay, no, we will go to war with Canada instantly if we have to." Mm-hmm. And that's exactly Putin's situation. You threaten his borders. I'm not saying I like his response, but we should not have gotten here. You should have understood what we are doing, I just want you called the name earlier. It's like George Bush had the pleasure of having James Baker III come and solve that.
The first Bush had James Baker.
Yes, we need a James Baker III now.
Yeah,
yes.
We definitely need the Velvet Hammer. Or a Richard Holbrooke, too, on the other side. One of the great incredible negotiator, incredible diplomat. Both those guys were amazing. It's unfortunate we lost Ambassador Holbrooke, but also I believe Secretary Baker obviously is too old. But we're missing that. I mean, I watched.
Listen. Put it this way: they threw up a 13-year-old to come and talk to me about global warming in the UN. to tell me about global warming.
That's
a 13-year-old.
Really? Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Imagine,
yeah,
I made her the ambassador for the world. What kind of crazy thing? So if she could be a spokesperson, you are actually an expert.
Well, the children jihad, right? But the thing is that, I mean, there's something else, you know. I mean, but it's important that we have dissent. It's important,
yes,
even when, you know, even against my ideas. Like I run my ideas by I run it through an intelligence system. I run it through old intelligence, retired guys, old CIA guys, ex-FBI, Joint Terrorism Task Force, good friend of mine. These are guys who know the world, who've been there, done it. I'll run my ideas by them. Some of them disagree. Some of them say, no, you know, we shouldn't do that, or that's too aggressive, or that's not aggressive enough. Some of them agree with the regime change in Russia. We'll worry about it later, you know, whatever. I mean, but that's okay. It's okay that we need these dissenting viewpoints. And I really don't understand people that are saying, you know, if someone points out the fact that Russia is, you know, not the totalitarian state of Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin, that you're suddenly a Putin lover. No, it doesn't mean you're a Putin lover. You're just pointing out the fact that if those two guys are bears, Putin's a great white shark. They're two totally different animals. Both can eat you alive, but you hunt them differently. One, you need a boat. The other, you probably need a Jeep and some hiking boots and a rifle. So, you know, they're two totally different. They're totally different animals. And, you know, that's why I don't like the allusions to World War II. Oh, it's Munich 1938 all over again. Well, yes, you can draw similarities with any situation, but no, it's a totally different situation because they didn't have a nuclear calculus in World War II. They didn't have it till after World War II when we used the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it's evolved with intercontinental ballistic missile delivery systems and now with hypersonic delivery systems. So the nuclear threat is totally different. You can literally within hours be at nuclear war. One wrong move and within it's a literal hourglass between that one wrong move that sparks an absolute global conflict that ends the world within hours.
Yes. And that's what I'm trying to tell.
It's going to be within hours.
I'm trying to tell these people who are, they're talking so much smack, and a lot of these reporters on Fox and CNN, but do you people understand what you're talking about? I listen to this guy talk. No, they don't. I listen to this guy talking about, one moment they're talking about putting a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Next moment, this guy was interviewed and was talking about bombing the Russian tanks that are moving into that city right now. Just bomb all. And another one said, why don't we just nuke Russia and take them out? I mean, so what would Putin and they do? Forget Putin. Do they not think that they have a whole level right below Putin already, have everything organized? This is World War III we're talking about.
It's very scary stuff, and the other thing is the belief that while Vladimir Putin may have had setbacks early on in the campaign, I'm not all convinced of two things. On the one hand, I'm not all convinced that the Russian military is as good as it's been cracked up to be in terms of Putin's resurgent military from the Russian propaganda. You know, we're building this military. They put on, I was discussing this with another expert, a military expert who's had tons of experience operating as a private military contractor throughout the world. And he pointed out to me, he's like, yeah, you see the digital camouflage. You see these AKs with all the high-speed optics looking like the high-speed M4s that we were rocking in Iraq and all this. But at the end of the day, underneath it, it could be just window dressing because they don't seem to be cracked troops, right? But then at the same time, he also pointed out, we're not seeing antennas on the armored columns. We're not seeing very many antennas, which indicates to me, and from the performance so far, that we're seeing still some of that underneath all that high speed modern weaponry and digital camouflage. That window dressing is still the same Soviet doctrine DNA, where the frontline troops aren't trusted to do their job without a hive sort of mentality, and really the information flow stops at the company commander. Which is why you don't see antennas on the tanks. You don't see individual units being directed to attack specific targets on the tactical front. And so interestingly, you know, they may still be in that sort of archaic mind, which is why they might get bogged down, which is also why they will resort to brutal force to get what they want. If President Putin surely does, as President Macron said the other day after his phone call, he wants Ukraine. He's going to take Ukraine. That'll be a brute force operation in that case. But I also don't believe that we've watched Putin's full strategy. On the other hand, having said all that about the military not being up to snuff, I don't believe we've seen his total strategy unfold yet. We haven't seen the mass introduction of the real crack units, the Soviet airborne, or excuse Soviet, the Russian airborne forces, the Spetsnaz units, full force. We haven't seen those guys get introduced. Those are the guys who won Chechnya. It was the Spetsnaz, it was the FSB, it was an asymmetric warfare fighting force that won Chechnya. If this gets bogged into an insurgency, this becomes an asymmetric war. And at that point, we're going to see those forces introduced full force and brutally so, and things change. And I don't know, we don't know what the phased-in strategy that Putin has. He has an amphibious, apparently an amphibious assault force sitting off of Odessa right now. He hasn't used it yet. He's got that armored column heading for Kiev. We don't know how he's going to use that. As General Petraeus said the other day on CNN, he could lay siege to Kiev and just starve them. You know, old medieval style. He could just starve them. I mean, that's true. He could do that. So we don't know. So this whole idea that the war is lost for Putin, I remember when we were declaring mission accomplished in Iraq in March 2003, I worked that event for the Republican Party of San Diego County when President Bush made that landing. I greeted the president as he came off Marine One back at North Island Naval Air Station. I was proud to do so. But that mission accomplished banner was already controversial by the time he landed. You remember he had it on the Abraham Lincoln?
Yes.
Mission accomplished behind him. That was May 2003, I believe. And he came back and landed at North Island Naval Air Station. And by the time he came back and landed, that was already a controversial banner because it was not accomplished. And it still wasn't accomplished when Obama was president. So that tells you how things can go either way. And we had ups and downs in Iraq, a lot of downs and a few ups. And General Petraeus had pacified the situation, and then it ruptured as soon as our security apparatus left, so it was lifted. What happens in this case, regarding Ukrainian security? But I want to point out that we let the Ukrainians down. We really let the Ukrainians down and protect. If we really wanted to protect the Ukrainians, we would have done them a favor, and we would have covered our flank while dealing with them on EU and NATO and all this sort of thing and getting them Western oriented at least. We would have, after the Crimea was annexed, we would have sought better diplomatic relations with the Russians in order to cover the Ukrainians. We would have protected them through diplomacy. Our diplomacy was weak. It was weak under President Obama, and it was weak in President Trump's sense, because
I agree with that.
In many ways, it was hobbled by the media because we were Russia, Russia, Russia for 4 years.
Yep.
And our own echo chamber of the media using that partisan view of Russia, you know, that they're these evil guys because they attacked our elections apparently or allegedly with a cyber attack. Well, they all do. They all cyber attack us. Even some of our allies are spying on us. Trust me on that. So, get over it. Move on. But for 4 years, we heard how Putin's the most evil man on earth, Russia, Russia, Russia. Oliver Stone went over to interview him to see, is this true? You know, what's this guy like? By the way, the Oliver Stone interviews, for anyone out there who wants to see a great interview of Vladimir Putin, really get to know what he's like or the kind of image he wants to project in detail, that's one of the best interviews of any head of state I've ever seen. There's that, you know, that's out there. But we had a failure of foreign policy for successive presidencies, and that's what's led to this situation in Ukraine.
Yes, and you know what? I agree with you fully, and I think President Trump's foreign policy was hobbled, particularly with regard to Russia. His hands were tied because of this incessant Russia, particularly with what the media was doing. And on top of that, he was dealing with the insanity of COVID. The COVID response between what Fauci and that task force. I mean, history will show. And I want to close off with you after I say my thing. It took Vladimir Putin, it's not a joke, but it took Vladimir Putin's brutal assault on Ukraine to end COVID, because now COVID is done. No one is reporting anything. The infections and deaths and cases seem to have disappeared. Because, look, Alex, I want to close off with you again, but you have a lot of parallels between what was done with COVID and how the media The media is very, very dishonest, very misleading, very political and very biased. And the media does a disservice to the public because what the public wants is honest, fair, truthful information. So I, Joe Public, I can make up my mind over the issue. I don't need your opinion. I don't want it. I just want the facts. And if you can't report the facts, don't report anything. And what the media did over the 2 years was reprehensible because we really had a virus that was coming through that had we only protected the vulnerable in society. This is what we were saying. Myself, Martin Kulldorff, Sunicha Gupta, Jay Bhattacharya, even Scott Atlas. That is our argument 2 years ago. We said, stop. Stop this lockdown. Open back up the society and the schools. Just properly, strongly, double down, triple down protections of the vulnerable in society. Granny in your nursing home and granny and your parents in your own home. You figure out how to do that. You take precautions. It's not the government's role. It's your role. And let the entire rest of society, the low-risk, healthy people in society, live largely unfettered lives, no touch by the government, no lockdowns, no school closures, nothing. Just leave them alone. We even had early treatment that became available that we learned that was very effective in cutting the risk of hospitalization and death by about 90%. We had these early treatment antivirals combined with corticosteroids and antiplatelet, anti-blood clotting drugs. We knew quickly that vitamin D was very important to cellular immunity. And most of the populations were vitamin D deficient. Even we found out that just about 30% of people in Florida had proper vitamin D levels. Even people that was playing golf for 16 hours a day. Sunshine alone does not cut it. You need some vitamin D supplements.
Sure.
So, you know, a little PSAs. We learned that obesity, morbid obesity, was a superloaded risk factor behind age. If you tease everything out of the equations, obesity emerges in regression equations we ran as the principal risk factor. And we could have spent 2 years public servicing the public, particularly amongst our minority communities who carry excess weight. This is not an accusatory thing because I can tell you coming from the islands originally, obesity and excess body weight is not affluence like in other countries. It is actually a sign of poverty because these people don't have the right money to mm-hmm. buy the proper food. So mm-hmm. when they get any income, they rush into the KFC and they buy 2-3 meals and they have no more food for the rest of the month. And they go to the grocery and they load up on potatoes and rice. They can't buy proper meat. They can't buy vegetables. But they need to keep the baby's belly full, the children, because you really don't want to hear the cry of a child who's hungry. I come from the island. I can tell you, it's not a nice thing to hear. It's a painful thing for a mother and a father.
Yeah.
So they had so many missed opportunities and squandered opportunities by our public service. And many, many, many people died. I was working in the Trump administration. Many business owners committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Many people who were laid off committed suicide. Mm-hmm. They hung themselves.
Yeah.
We had reports coming up into the individual states of young children, less than 10 years old, committing suicide. And it shocked President Trump. And I can tell you, when you saw him on the podium, fighting the task force, literally turning around and arguing with Fauci, that was real. He fought those people on that task force to open schools, open the society, and they fought him and they subverted him. History will show that what happened in this pandemic response, they have some real issues that I say border on criminality. Do you know why? Because they knew the science. We gave it to them. We kept showing them what they were doing were wrong. And they kept doing it. So this this move beyond science is something other than science was at play here. And we caused the deaths of thousands of Americans by our own modeling.
Well, there's right a lot now of we politics.
It's about politics.
Yeah.
It was about hurting Trump. I'm saying it to you. This is a very, very critical interview we're having because people are going to hear your voice and your balance and intellect like they've never heard before. And
well, I'm vaccinated, but I don't believe it should be mandated. It's my body, my choice.
Right.
You know,
and you balance your own risk profile. Mm-hmm. You take, you make decisions as you see.
Yes, I did. And you know I did because I discussed it with you.
Yes. And the issue here is that the vaccine mandates to mandate people to take a vaccine when we did not have the clear indications of the efficacy as well as the safety profile. And here's the key, Alex. The key is for a large proportion of people, the vaccine works well. It appears to work fine. They don't have a problem with it. But there's a large proportion of the population that very soon after the vaccine, 1 to 2 days post-vaccine, as much as 5 to 7. Because when we look at the curve, it flattens out quickly after about a week to 14 days. Those people have severe adverse events, and it's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. What the vaccine developers fail to do is figure out who those people are so that the vaccine should not have been indicated for them. But with this carte blanche vaccine, everybody, we have a bunch of people that have died from the vaccine. You, as an example, took the vaccine and you've done well.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many people who've not.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, in a proper vaccine trial, because we run it for 10, 15 years, we are able to point out the at-risk groups and exclude them from that drug or that vaccine or that medical device. We did not do that here. So something went wrong. And we need to go back and hold some public inquiries to hold people to account. But COVID is done.
Yeah.
It's over. It's
yeah,
over.
That's of the State of the Union and
yeah.
the invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah. And
both
and,
those events and
yeah.
COVID. They're
Vladimir.
Actually the cure.
Yes.
I'd actually believe that more than what's coming out of Big Pharma. That's one thing I think should be noted. Before I went to the London School of Economics, I did 4 years at the University of Southern California, and I was a theater major in the School of Dramatic Arts and an acting major. And one of the guys in the program was a guy named Danny Strong, and he just made an excellent miniseries that was out last autumn called Dope Sick, which with Michael Keaton, which is about the Sackler family and the OxyContin epidemic and how corrupt –
That was criminal.
How criminal it was and how corrupt the Sackler family and how much in cahoots Big Pharma was with the FDA and the approvals on it and keeping warnings off of the Oxy and all this sort of thing. And Danny wrote an incredible and directed an incredible miniseries, which I recommend to everybody, which shows the inside baseball and all this. And then go watch the documentary about the same subject, the Sacklers. It was on HBO. And I don't know how anyone can say that we should just blindly trust Big Pharma and our government and the FDA to do all the right things all the time when this happened with OxyContin separately. It's ludicrous. I mean, if you want to have a vaccine, I did it. It was my choice, and I made the choice based on a rational decision for myself and my risk factors and all this. But the fact of the matter is I don't blindly trust Big Pharma. I mean, they're about as morally they make the big tobacco look like a choir boys. I mean,
yes.
You know, big tobacco never claimed that they were curing anybody. They just claimed their product wasn't killing anybody. These guys are curing you on top of not killing you. You know, we're curing you.
I think, look, I want to close off with you. I'll just say
sure.
that these alphabet agencies like the CDC, the NIH, FDA and stuff. President Trump, I could tell you something. Had he been elected the second term, quickly he was going to take them down to the studs.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to fumigate those agencies. I know. He was going to fire top down. So let's see what happens in the future because that's what is needed. Those agencies have become politicized, biased. They're not operating based on the science. I mean, we just saw the New York Times writing a devastating article on the CDC, accusing them of hiding information and withholding critical information on persons 18 to 49 in terms of the efficacy for the third booster shot.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because I know the data. The data shows that the vaccine fails. But the vaccine is also harmful. That is illegal for what the CDC has done and criminal. And hearings should be called. But right now, the Democrats hold the House. They're not going to call no hearings. And it's a 50-50 in the Senate. So the Democrats are not going to call. But I can tell you, if the Republicans win back the House and Senate, we're going to investigate that matter because that is criminal. CDC has violated law there. So let me close off with you, Alex. Help
sure.
us here. Tell us in a few minutes, just a few, because you've been so gracious with your time.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tell us how you would, if they gave Alex Holstein 1 hour to bring together the right people and to close this off and to end this Ukraine-Russia and to bring the right people from Russia, bring the right people from Ukraine, from the United States. I think the main players here is Ukraine, Russia, the United States, maybe a couple of players in Europe to the table to solve this. What would you do?
Well, right now, I mean, you know, you want to engage in talks as soon as possible, but we don't want to also look desperate to end it, because that puts Putin in the power position to demand terms. But at the same time, I think the sanctions have to take further hold and hurt him more, hurt his cadre more, to put pressure internally on. I don't believe there's going to be an uprising in Russia. They may not be the World War II generation, but they are descended from people that survived the siege of Leningrad. So I don't think the economic woes. They also survived the Yeltsin years too, which were horrific economically for them, huge hyperinflation. So I don't know if Russians are going to rise up because they're mad at Putin for invading Ukraine. I think that's amplified in the West. So I think it really comes down to engaging in Ukraine, I think, in a clandestine fashion, setting up our forward projection. And I think it's going to be a long haul thing. I think the first phase we are now in a deep freeze, evolution of the Cold War. And, you know, in this modern age, we are in a Cold War with Russia. We have to acknowledge that. We have to behave according and adapt to the Moscow rules, while building our own rules of it. We have to, I think, doing things like making a big thing about bringing Finland and Sweden into NATO is a good negotiating tactic as well. But I think we need to aim for phase two within the next year or so, where we end up with detente. This is separate from just solving Ukraine and getting him out of Ukraine, but where we end up in detente with Russia. And then phase three, hopefully a rapprochement a la the Gorbachev years, but it's going to be a long haul thing. But in the meantime, with Ukraine, what we hope is that it builds into a protracted insurgency that becomes intolerable for Russian forces and for him, and that he pulls back to the Donbass. I always felt that he would take the Donbass region, be welcomed as sort of liberators there, because it's so pro-Russian, and then call it a day. But I think I think he still might do that. I think that's why he might be prodding in Ukraine. That might be why it's such a stalled sort of invasion. It's not a quick snap blitzkrieg as we were promised, because I think that he's seeing how far he can push it to get what he wants, because maybe he can negotiate out of us, okay, just fall back to the Donbass. You can have the Donbass. That can be part of Russia, but we need security guarantees for Ukraine. And we'll guarantee they won't join NATO and EU, but we need security guarantees for Ukraine. And then we have to take it from there. But I think that's the best we can hope for in terms of, you know, bringing peace back to the actual land in Ukraine and Ukraine proper. But I think the Ukrainians are going to fight for as long as they can. And I think they'll fight pretty long. They have a history of partisanship, not our kind of partisanship, but the actual kind of partisan resistance that occurred during World War II. So I think they're going to fight for a very long time, and I think they're going to make it difficult for Vladimir Putin, which means he's going to double down and get brutal if he does want the whole country. Yeah, he will. He'll do Chechnya. If he considers Ukraine truly part of Russia, as he seems to, if he truly believes his own propaganda on that, as he seems to, and which the Russians have this sort of, you know, somewhat semi-valid worldview regarding that, at least of their own history, it's their true perspective, then he'll do what they did in Chechnya. Chechnya was part of Russia. Chechnya was an internal part of Russia. It's like Oklahoma, and they just totally razed it to the ground. You know, they destroyed it, like Lincoln and the southern states. I mean, destroyed it.
But what I say, Alex, then is this. I agree with you. I actually thought he was moving to the Donbass and stopping there. I did not think this was going to happen, to be honest with you. It shocked me too. But what I also, when I'm looking, what I'm seeing is, it's almost like a slow grind. And that's why I'm pleading and I'm hoping that even the President Zelensky, people from the White House, Putin, they come to the table, because if this goes on and on and on, he will flatten Ukraine. And that is, he will destroy everything.
Yes.
To take it. And that's, you're taking a beautiful country to it, all of these massive, beautiful buildings and architecture. And this is the tragedy of the situation. And we need the kind of calm heads. We need the right person to come in there and broker some kind of peace and stop. At this point, there's so much disaster already. We really need a James Baker to do.
Yeah, I agree completely. I don't think now is the time to engage those negotiations unless the Russians ask for them.
Yes.
You know, because otherwise it seems like we're just giving up Ukraine and that will be on the table. I mean, it's interesting that they're engaging in these sort of pseudo talks with the Ukrainians. I think that's all. I think there's theater behind that or in front of that. So I don't know what's going on behind there. We have to wait and see what happens, but the war is going to go on. And I think he's going to try to pacify it the way he did Chechnya. Look, he had tremendous success in Chechnya. Everyone said that was impossible. He'd never get that insurgency under to heal, bring it to heal. And he did. He did through brutal force and asymmetric warfare. He was able to take Ramzan Kadyrov and make him his guy. That's his guy now. That guy was the head of the, you know, resistance. That's his guy. What's scary is, you know, in Ukraine, you have these nuclear plants, and I think the Russians attacked that nuclear plant on purpose they did it on purpose, but I think that was almost a veiled threat to the West. Look what we're willing to do if you mess with us. Look how far we're willing to go. But what if terrorists get in there in this situation? What if foreign fighters show up, a third party, or even Chechens, Al-Qaeda Chechens, Al-Qaeda affiliated Chechens show up and start messing with places like that while the situation is insecure? This is a very, very bad situation in Ukraine right now. But I don't think he's going to attack a NATO country. Unless provoked, I don't think he's going to see a phantom provocation of any kind. I don't think that's his goal. I don't think the domination that he's going to roll Russian tanks across Europe. I think he knows better. I think he knows better just because what happened to the Soviets, they couldn't hold Eastern Europe. It was just too expensive. Russia can't afford it. And he doesn't have he doesn't have a 5 million man army. He doesn't have what the Soviets had. He has 300,000. I think 300,000 in ground forces total. So 280, and he's got everything in Ukraine right now. This is the bulk of the Russian armed forces are mounted for battle in Ukraine right now. The majority of his forces. So this is the best he can do. But he's putting it all in. So we'll see.
So Alex, look, let me close by saying that I'm going to put this out because I think it was very, very fascinating to hear your perspective. And also, I want to see how things unfold in the next week or two, and we'll invite you back.
That'd be great.
I'm sure you are going to be requested to go into some media shows. And I think the world is going to benefit from hearing your perspective on Russia and Ukraine, Putin, et cetera. And because what we're getting right now is too one-sided. And what was happening here is wrong. But at the same time, there's always other sides, and there's always a much fuller picture. And that's what we need to understand. We're dealing with not just a bully or not just somebody who invaded another country for their reasons, but we're dealing with an equally powerful country. And we have to be very careful because you don't want to put his back up against the wall too much and cause huge problems. And you don't want one of these other countries to think they could take a poke at him, because he will be ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I just want to finish off by saying that, first of all, thank you for having me. It's been great. I love this conversation. Could go on for, as you know, hours.
I know.
secondly, I just want to plug my book one more time, Warfighter.
Yes, please. Tell us what you've done. Tell us the books that you've just written and how people could find Alex Holstein right now.
Okay, well, the book is called Warfighter, the story of an American fighting man, and it's by Colonel Jesse Johnson and me with Alex Holstein, and you can find it on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or all the book sites. It's for pre-sale right now. It launches May 15th, so you get your copy May 15th or May 16th if you order right now on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. And it's, again, Warfighter, the story of an American fighting man. It covers the life of one of our most highly decorated special operations soldiers, Colonel Jesse Johnson, one of the most highly decorated special operations soldiers living today, one of the most highly decorated American veterans living today, 40 years of warfare from Vietnam, where he was a highly decorated two-tour company commander with in his second tour with the 9th Infantry, where he earned 4 Bronze Stars, 3 Silver Stars, and the Distinguished Service Cross. Former deputy commander of Delta Force, was the first boots on the ground in Iran during the hostage rescue, and also commanded all special operations during the Gulf War, reporting directly to General Schwarzkopf. And we have endorsements from General Petraeus, General David Petraeus, former head of CIA, General Peter Schumacher, former chief of staff of the United States Army, Joe Galloway, as I mentioned, author of We Were Soldiers, David McCloskey, former CIA officer and author of Damascus Station, a great novel, and also Mrs. Brenda Schwarzkopf, the widow of General Schwarzkopf. And the book, it goes all the way from Vietnam through the Gulf War and the Iraq War, where at 65 years old, Colonel Johnson was duking it out with Al-Qaeda outside Baghdad on Route Irish, leading a team of 40 military contractors who are all ex-Delta Force. He is a legend. And he has an awe-inspiring story, and all I had to do was rise to the occasion of writing it and live up to his life, rise to the occasion, make the writing rise to the occasion of his life. I hope I did that. Our editor thinks so. It's coming from Lions Press, May 15th, 2022. Warfighter, the story of a fighting man. Yeah.
Where could people find you if they want to subscribe to something? Because I remember we were talking about Substack, and I think like my own Substack is drpaulalexander.com. People try to find each other on Substack now straight. I think you should set up your own Substack.
Okay,
Alex Holstein. That's it.
Okay.
Alex space Holstein. So if we say it now, people would expect the next day or two you to put out a Substack, and they will be able to find your writings there, even if it's a daily blurb, because you could make the decision. People could subscribe freely.
Okay.
As well as people could support you, support the work that you're doing. And many
That'd
people opt for the support, and people give, like my own Substack is Alexander COVID News. That's how I set it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may tweak the name if you suggest Alexander COVID News, but I think you should have, because of the kind of intellect and scope that you could provide the globe right now, because people from all over the world like read my stack and read other people's. So I think you should do that and give people the chance, the choice to subscribe freely. They don't need to pay, as well as some people may pay a couple of dollars a month in support, because I know the work that you're doing and the value of it. So is there any other place people could reach you at right
now? Yes, right now I'm on Instagram @StableShadow. You can hit me up there and send me an invite, and I'll check you out, and you can join my Instagram. Instagram, and at geopoliticalmonitor.com, where I do a lot of writing, which I'll probably link to Substack, and I am going to set up a Substack. Possibly it'll either be Alex Holstein or it'll be under the Stable Shadow moniker.
Excellent.
But you should put
the Alex Holstein name in there.
It'll be there.
So people could find, if they Google it, they will find it.
Yeah.
Excellent. I think you should do that, because you have, I've always argued, more value than most people I'm looking at right now. And the world needs just common sense, but people who are serious, smart people on an issue. We don't want to listen to these frack people on Fox and CNN and ABC and stuff. It's driving us nuts. Because they're going to push us to nuclear war.
Well, and you always have to be skeptical of warmongers. I mean, and jingoists, people saying we need to go. It's always other people's kids who fight those wars. As I was discussing with Joe Calloway, it's always the poor that fight those wars.
Yes.
You know, and poor young men and women will go fight this war and have to sift through a radioactive murk wearing NBC suits while the Lindsey Grahams of the world sit at home, you know, drinking champagne in a bunker somewhere.
Yeah, you know what? If you know his number or know somebody, please give Lindsey a call and tell him, calm the hell down and stop talking that crap, please.
He's a nice guy.
Yes.
Yeah, he's got to stop.
Yeah, he has to stop. Okay, Alex.
All right, take care.
I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Paul. Take care. Right. Bye-bye. Thank you.
BrianDeon.tv audiences, this is the Dr. Artist Show. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Artist. We've got an exciting two segments today with Dr. Paul Elias Alexander. And if any of you guys know what Daystar TV Network is, love the Lambs and love what they are doing, but they invited me and Dr. Paul Elias Alexander in early December to come to Daystar and do a bunch of shows together, which was exciting. So maybe you've seen that. If you haven't seen them, go check out Daystar's video library. Check out our shows that we did together there, which were phenomenal. Dr. Paul Alexander holds a PhD. He's also an epidemiologist, which I love. And we're going to get him to tell us what that is, because him and Dr. Peter McCullough both study and actually have a career based on epidemiology, which is phenomenal, which is very important for right now. And on the cusp of the news this morning that our wonderful President Joe Biden and his administration, did you hear the White House is distributing 400 million things for free to America? Find out what that is. It might change the world.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow. Cancel culture has not only affected myself and MyPillow, but millions of you out there. My employees and I want to personally thank each and every one of you for all of your support. At MyPillow, we not only have pillows, but we have hundreds of products, including my new slippers, bathrobes, sleepwear, and my new beds. We're offering the best gifts ever for the best prices ever. For example, we have this exclusive offer on the standard size MyPillows, regularly $69.98, now only $19.98 with your promo code. We also have the queen size MyPillows, regularly $79.98, now only $24.98 with your promo code. And we have the king size, regularly $89.98, now only $29.98 with your promo code. So go to MyPillow.com now and use the promo code on your screen or call the 1-800 number below to receive this exclusive offer.
Welcome back, Brighteon.tv fans. Mike Adams, we love you. Thank you for creating this platform. Today's Dr. Artist Show is coming to you, sponsored by the North Texas Healing Center. It is a holistic wellness clinic focusing on locating and eliminating the causes for symptoms and diseases. They specialize in chiropractic treatment, massage therapy, emotional release technique, nutritional response technique, and alternative health care. Contact them today at NorthTexasHealingCenter.com or call them at 214-705-9369. The second sponsor for today's show is MyPillow.com and Mike Lindell's company. He's producing and manufacturing here in the United States products like sheets for your beds, pillows, towels, slippers for your feet. He's also got dog beds, which are phenomenal. We love the towels. They're our favorite things. Actually, somebody spent the night at our house the other day, a good friend of ours, and called me last night and said, this is not a joke, last night, called me and said, what were the sheets on that bed that he took a nap on? He said, I'm buying some of those sheets. And I said, oh, we actually got those from MyPillow.com. Anyway, check out their products. For our audiences, Mike Lindell has actually given us a promo code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R, or the abbreviation DR at checkout, and it will populate even bigger discounts for you. Thank you for all your support. All of you who have purchased anything from MyPillow for your home or consider to do so, I really appreciate it. It's been very helpful to us as a team trying to have time and investment to be able to continue doing research on your behalf and producing these actual interviews and traveling and speaking engagements. All right, so I want you to know also, this is for the audiences, you should know. Just yesterday, I got an email from Mike Lindell's support team. It's phenomenal the reach of conspiracy and attempts to actually, you know, destroy an individual's reputation or his company's. They're doing it to all kinds of people. But I just found out yesterday that the banks that support each of Mike Lindell's companies are actually demanding them close their accounts, because it might come up in the media one day that they bank, that they are the bank for Mike Lindell's companies, and they don't want to be associated with his name. It could be controversial, or, you know, might create a bad reputation for the banks, which they've used for decades now. So anyway, support Mike Lindell. It's pretty awful what's going on. Anyway, today's show, we're going to actually have on the show, at least we have planned, to have Dr. Paul Elias Alexander. Let me take you through some of his credentials, because he's got credentials I don't have. So before we get to him, if we can get him on the line, and if we don't, I've got all kinds of cool stuff we'll talk about. All right, so Dr. Alexander, if you don't know who he is, if you haven't ever heard yet of brownstone.org, it's a collection of research studies that are being used around the world by governments, politicians, by doctors, by administrators, health professionals, and health agencies. It's phenomenal what he's doing. He is a nonstop resource. But Dr. Paul Alexander Elias puts most of that research there on brownstone.org. He has an experience in epidemiology and in the teaching of clinical epidemiology, evidence-based medicine, and research methodology. Dr. Alexander is a former assistant professor at McMaster University and the former COVID pandemic evidence synthesis consultant advisor to the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the PAHO in Washington, D.C. Now, that's a great bio. I don't have any association with the WHO other than actually unveiling all the things they're doing that are corrupt. For the COVID pandemic policy, he was put in a position for that in the Department of Health and Human Services early in the pandemic in Washington, D.C. Also in 2008, was appointed with the World Health Organization as a regional specialist and epidemiologist in Europe's regional office in Denmark, which is awesome. I've never been to Denmark. And then he worked for the government of Canada as an epidemiologist for 12 years. I know he's in New York right now. That's where he lives with his wife and kids. From 2017 to 2019 at Infectious Disease Society of America, Virginia, USA. And currently a COVID-19 consultant researcher in the U.S. C-19 research group. All right, now this C-19 research group, that last thing I just told you, Dr. Paul Elias Alexander literally provides tons of research articles. Him and David Wiseman, who I've had on this show, do a phenomenal job every day. David Wiseman told me personally he goes through about 400 research studies a day that he is literally sifting through on PubMed.gov or other sites that collect research studies that are published and peer-reviewed. And he goes through them daily, deciphering which ones are accurate, which ones are fraudulent, and then which ones are important for us to have as we continue to go out and actually educate you. So let me tell you something that's very exciting. He actually put together he compiled a list. If you go to brownstone.org, this is very recent, December 20th of 2021, just a couple weeks ago. It's actually titled More Than 150 Comparative Studies and Articles on Mask Ineffectiveness and Harms. Now, I bring this up because I personally am not a fan of talking about masks. Of all the things surrounding COVID-19, this is the one that has the least amount of interest for me. Why? Because the drugs they're using in hospitals are far more deadly. They lead to death. I guess masks can too, and create disease and infection, obviously. However, drugs being pumped into your veins to me are far worse than a mask. And then number two, the vaccines that they're actually campaigning for and their entire agenda is to actually get every single one of you injected with their experimental drug is far more dangerous to me than the masks. So it's not that masks aren't important. It's not that masks aren't an issue. I actually believe the masks are actually being used nonstop just to control you, to use what they have found effective in religious cults, which is articles of clothing to wear. If you can condition people to wear certain clothing or articles, this actually conditions the behavior of the individual to drop their ability to have reasoning, logical thought, common sense. It devoids them of that. And it creates what's called cognitive dissonance, and they actually will just follow whatever their leaders tell them. So I think this is just a continued conditioning to get people to believe there's a invisible threat out there of a virus, COVID-19 or any of its variants. And the reason why I want to bring it up today, we have actually shared these articles with legislators around the country. as they instill mandates into schools or healthcare systems or public arenas. The masks don't work. So the masks don't restrict or reduce the actual infectious rate or the hospitalization rate of anybody from viral infections, influenza infections, respiratory viruses of any kind. But here's a group of 150 studies that have been reviewed, peer-reviewed, published, that Dr. Paul Elias Alexander at brownstone.org has put together. Please check it out. Anybody who wants resources as to why it is this might be harmful or ineffective, I think we should just be focusing on things that are effective. And I want you to know this morning, it was announced, I just saw an alert in the Washington Post, for those of you who read it, found this phenomenal. The Washington Post reports that Joe Biden's administration and the White House are going to be sending out, by the end of this week, 400 million N95 masks for free to tens of thousands of pharmacies where the vaccines are being given out, the COVID-19 shots. Now, I was so excited to talk to Paul Elias about this and find out what his opinions were. We'll see if we can get him on the phone here, but and on the call. But why is this shocking to me? I find it absurd, actually, that we're investing money into masks that have not proven to be effective to reduce the spread, reduce the pandemic, to stop the pandemic, or any of these variants. I don't understand why it is that we're not using things. For example, like in China. In China, early on, in January of 2020, they determined that the individuals in China who had contracted COVID-19 and started developing the pneumonia-like symptoms associated with COVID-19, they found only one thing was effective at actually clearing up 100% of them and getting them home, and that was high-dose intravenous vitamin C. And then the Chinese government went into action and actually started supplying to their citizens for free vitamin C in their home, which, why aren't we doing that here? Why are we still negating the impact of natural therapies to actually help us combat an infection? I just don't understand. So, Paul Elias Alexander, you're here. I see you. How are you, buddy?
Not bad. How are you, sir?
I just got your op-ed that you put together on brownstone.org that was published December 20th. You've probably added to that. But the one you actually, it's titled More Than 150 Comparative Studies and Articles on Mask Ineffectiveness and Harms. Now, the reason why I bring this up, I told my audience already, it's not the most exciting topic for me, these masks. I think the vaccines are more dangerous. I think the hospital protocols are more dangerous. I think the lockdowns are more emotionally and physically damaging. However, did you hear this morning? I bet you already knew this, Paul. Did you know that Joe Biden and the White House decided this morning they were going to push out for free 400 million N95 masks for free to tens of thousands of pharmacies around the country, and they're going to start by the end of this week, and they are going to be giving at least, this will offer at least three of these N95 masks for every adult in the United States. And they believe this is a measure that's going to actually stop the spread and continuation of the pandemic. And the fact that you've been an expert at putting together this list of masks, I want you, on the cusp of this news that just came out this morning, Dr. Paul Alexander, I want you to tell the world just how effective and exciting you might be about these 400 million masks being given out by our federal government.
Hi, Dr. Addis. Thanks a lot for having me again. It's always remarkable to speak to somebody like you. And look, this is very, it's almost illogical to me, because when we look at this, the body of evidence, so it was not one study or one piece of evidence. We look at the body of evidence, so that's the evidence in totality. And that op-ed, if you go to it, again, it's kind of funny in the sense that we are writing almost scientific papers that should be in peer-reviewed journals. The peer-reviewed journals are not taking our work. So we now have been going towards Brownstone, Epoch News, etc., to publish, because that's the only way we're going to get our work out. Like Dr. McCullough published and Jessica Rose published a very, very important scientific paper on myocarditis recently. And after being vetted by the peer reviewers, independent peer reviewers approved, vetted by the editorial team, And then the publisher, it ran for about 5 or 6 days, and then the publisher took it down. And that particular study, they took it down just before the FDA's important meeting on deciding about the vaccines. And that particular study showed that young persons, particularly males, I think 90% were male, have a dramatically elevated risk of getting myocarditis and landing up in a hospital post-vaccination. So this is what we faced. We are faced with severe censorship by the scientific community, by the journals, the journal editors, etc. And it's a terrible situation because we can't get the science out. So we are writing op-eds. So anyway, I just want to give that backstop. Now, 150 pieces of evidence, and overall in the area of masking, the science and the research has been very low quality, very questionable, very patchy, based largely on observational studies, so a lot of them confounded, etc. However, there were a couple of RCTs in there, but the point I'm making is, if you look at the body of evidence across all of the studies, the comparative studies that we looked at, the science is very stable, and there are a few seminal ones, and I'll point out to them here. There was that one in Sweden by Ludvigsen, where they looked at the 2 million Swedish kids between 0 to 16 across this pandemic, and they went to school for the entire pandemic. No school closures, no lockdowns, basically, and no masking. And of all of the Swedish kids from 0 to 16, we found no instances of death. And the key with that study is that there was no masking. In other words, that study actually worked in reverse. It showed that there was no need for masks. There's the Paris Island Marine study that looked at the Marine recruits in the United States in 2020, and who were quarantined for 2 weeks before going on to base in Paris Island, and then 2 weeks during the training period. So 1 month of quarantine. These soldiers, these Marine recruits on Paris Island were heavily controlled. They were separated, social distancing, everything, and mask, double mask. And we found at the end of the study, the researchers published and showed that there was still transmission of infection. So even with, in a marine environment with commanders and stuff, ensuring that all of the controls were in place, there was still transmission of the infection. We have that study in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, which showed that double vaccinated nurses. That study actually showed us for the first time clearly, it was published in Lancet by Chow et al., that double vaccinated nurses became infected. It was that study along with the Barnstable Massachusetts outbreak that caused the CDC director to rush to the podium to say double vaccinated people need to put on a mask. However, it was nonsensical on her part because the study, embedded in the study, and one out of Israel and a similar nosocomial outbreak out of Finland, all three of these studies showed something very alarming, which is that whilst it showed that double vaccinated nurses were transmitting infection, getting infected and actually transmitting, and the Vietnam study showed 251 times viral load, which that they put out as the key finding, which was stunning on its own, embedded in those studies was the fact that those nurses were PPE'd and masked. And that I found was the prominent finding because it demonstrated that even in a hospital environment with healthcare professionals, PPE, full mask, they were still transmitting this virus to all of their patients and all of their other colleagues. So the bottom line is this. And in that op-ed, there's the Danish mask study, which became the seminal study showing that there was no difference in transmission between, that's basically key RCT, between those with masks and those not masks. And there was a recent study in Bangladesh, I think you've heard about this one, the cluster randomized study, where they found that they reported some benefit in the surgical mask. But when we look at the data clearly, the confidence intervals range from 0 to about 13%. That means that there's no benefit, zero, to a modest benefit of 13% with the surgical mask and nothing, no benefit in the cloth mask. And let me just be as clear as I can. The entire body of evidence today tells us that the blue surgical masks and the white masks are highly ineffective. They don't stop transmission and they don't affect the dynamics of the spread in any manner. And the fact that the government now is pushing these 400 million N95 masks, the issue with that is that the N95 masks have a host of problems, and we never questioned whether the N95 mask would be of more utility in the general population, but the N95 mask is not a blue surgical mask to begin with, which is that once you touch it and you remove the sealed fitting of it, it becomes almost irrelevant. It does not do its job anymore. It fails. And we know that you can't wear an N95 mask for a prolonged period of time. It's very uncomfortable and causes oxygen deprivation as well as carbon dioxide buildup behind the mask. So at this point, here's the key. We have to look at that decision by the government. I think it's just reaching for something to make themselves seem relevant and doing something. COVID is over. COVID has been over, I would argue, over a year now. And Omicron is their off-ramp and their opportunity to take this as a gift to just declare victory in some manner and let us go on with our lives, because Omicron has presented us such a mild, almost common cold variant that I think when you listen to people like Dr. Robert Malone, Dr. McCullough, even when you look at how I've written up these papers and stuff, we are basically saying that the society needs to calm down and understand that Omicron is like a vaccine in itself. And if you had the two vaccines, which I've been against these vaccines day one, but if you've had, don't take a booster. And this is just my opinion. You make your decision with your doctor. But Omicron is your booster. And if you've not had these vaccines, well, then Omicron is your vaccine. Omicron will provide you the immunity that you need. And I think it's almost nonsensical putting out these 400 million masks and asking the public to still mask. Particularly, I'm seeing these places that are talking about masking in the outdoors, where there's almost zero transmission. You don't transmit the virus in the outdoors. So it's almost like they're trying to take us back to February, March of 2020. So it's bizarre. Bottom line, these masks have been ineffective day one. We've shown that in separate papers, that the mask mandates in not one place in America, not one state, and not one country in the world, where a mask mandate was implemented across this pandemic for the entire period, was there a decline in infections. In fact, we could show in each graph that where you implemented a mask mandate, infections actually went up. So the masks are ineffective, period.
Dr. Paul Elias Alexander, thank you for all of your hard work. You're phenomenal at putting together all these researches for these research studies for us, so we can put them together easily, relate to them, and share them with our audiences. I want to actually define a couple things for the audience. I'd like to make sure there's no confusion here. Can you please define for the audience what an op-ed is? OP-ED.
Okay. Well, an op-ed in its simplest form is an opinion piece, so that you are taking a topic and you are laying out your view on it and you're discussing it and sharing what you think. So over the years, a lot of different news outlets have gotten very prominent op-ed systems running, and we turn to these. They generally should be about 800 to 1,000 words. But
good. I just wanted to define that because we're going to have to go to break here in about 10 seconds. Next thing that you said RCTs a couple times. RCTs, just for the audience, means randomized clinical trials. But there's tons of censorship here. We got about 5 seconds. We're going to be back with Dr. Paul Elias Alexander. We're going to find out where this pandemic's going because, as you said, it's over.
This is the first time in history of the 140 years of our pharmaceutical medical history in America that there's ever been a disease where we said, wait till you're really sick before you go get treated. If a kid sprains their ankle, they don't look at that kid and go, you know what, you should wait 4 days till it gets really swollen and then ice it. You should always start treating it early. The drug Anthony Fauci chose to be the mandated drug, and that's called remdesivir. It wasn't FDA approved ever. Then he stated there were 2 studies that proved it safe and effective against the Ebola virus, and because of that study, it warrants its use in the coronavirus. It was already found to be the most deadly of the 4 experimental drugs in the Ebola trial. There's going to be a huge amount of autoimmune diseases that are going to be contributed directly to these shots. However, the time between the two of them is going to allow them to get away with liability.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Brian Artis. This is the Dr. Artis Show, I'm trying to be a voice of reason. And I've got Dr. Paul Elias Alexander here on the screen. I want the world to say hi to him. Now, I want Dr. Paul Elias Alexander, which is one of my favorite people in this entire movement trying to save the planet and make sense of the chaos in the world. Paul Elias Alexander, there's a term I've heard for several of you, and I actually want you to define it for me and for the audiences, because this is relevant to why people should listen to the likes of you. I want you to explain to the audiences around the world, when you have in your bio epidemiology, and Dr. Peter McCullough is an epidemiologist, what in the world is an epidemiologist?
When you're looking at something like disease, infections, etc., you want to get a fair understanding of where it is, where it's going to, the risks and all of that around it. So an epidemiologist is someone who studies infections similar to like how, not just infectious diseases though, but chronic diseases also. So just the burden of disease in terms of morbidity, which is illness, and mortality, which is death. But we try to look at things principally, bread and butter epidemiology tries to frame every issue in terms of person, place, and time. So who's at risk? And a good description of a good profile of who's at risk, where this illness is, where we think it's going to go next, and time. We want to generate what we call an epidemic curve from where the source infection began, the source exposure, to where the peak infections are, which is generally top of the curve, to try and describe the distribution and describe what is happening. So it's like an actuarial scientist for an insurance company that looks at like life tables, etc., to denote your risk of death so that the insurance company can offer you insurance based on your risk profile. An epidemiologist is a similar, but for diseases. And prior, we looked more like outbreak investigations so that if there's a function, if there's a situation where there's been an outbreak of cases of something, an epidemiologist could be called to the scene and they conduct a basic investigation, epidemiological outbreak investigation, where we try to figure out what was the source of the outbreak, what was the source, pathogen, or cause. And we try to describe it based on what are the exposure risks, what potentially caused that outbreak, and therefore measures to contain it. And that's the key, to describe as effectively as possible so we could contain the future spread and prevent future transmission. So
you've been asked by multiple governments, the World Health Organizations, to behave and actually function as an epidemiologist. Do you feel like the federal health agencies of our government, do you feel like they've relied on epidemiologists to help them understand, bring some, you know, validity to this crisis and some resolution to the crisis? Do you think they've relied on you guys?
No. And I think the problem is that I think, Leslie, you know, there's so much we could talk about and for like hours, but I'll answer that question this way. I think my own impression has been that even in the prior president, Trump, and even this president, this pandemic response moved and always operated not as a public health response, but as a political response, so that all of their decisions are based on politics. And you could see that by how the CDC, which the CDC is the marquee public health agency in the world, yet I would say over the last decades they have become more of a political agency, and they operate depending on the government in power and in terms of their messaging. So like yesterday I'm looking at different news clips, and I'm seeing even on CNN, which is CDC friendly, and it's not that you want to be unfriendly to the CDC, but covers over all of the missteps and devastating errors, to be honest, is now talking about they're replacing the director of the CDC because of the miscommunication or even in some instances false communications, in my opinion, and because it is glaring. They don't serve the government well, and they don't serve, their role is to serve the public. They're not serving the public well. And I like to remind the public something. In the first 5 weeks of this outbreak, of this pandemic, or what you want to call it, I never thought it was a pandemic. To me, this was an emergency. This was a problem that we needed to look at and take certain steps in January, February of 2020. That itself is a separate discussion, because as time goes by, we're beginning to understand that this was actually circulating before that, like mid of 2019. So that is a separate, very difficult conversation to have, which I think we will have in the future as more becomes known. But in the first 5 weeks of this matter, the CDC decided that it will produce the diagnostic test that is going to be the diagnostic test. And if you go back for the first 5 weeks, what the nation did not know is that the United States was blind to this virus, to this whatever it was, because the diagnostic test that the CDC developed and they sent out to the commercial labs and to the respective laboratories in America, and you know, in the beginning we'd beta test it to validate the test, these tests were quickly realized to be catastrophically flawed. They were contaminated. And so it had to stop. Testing had to stop for about 5 weeks. And recently, Dr. Robert Redfield, who was the then director of CDC, did an interview on CNN with Dr. Sanjay Gupta. And it surprised me, because he said what I knew, because I was there in some manner. He said that the test that the CDC put out was devastating, because it had America flying blind for 5 weeks. And I can tell you, the virus seeded across the eastern and western coast of America and all of those states for about 5 weeks. We didn't know where it was and exactly what was happening. Whilst other countries, even lesser developed countries, were way ahead of America, that initial CDC botched test hobbled the response. And people like Brett Giroir, who's the testing person in the task force, I'll give him some credit, because he had to work overtime just to keep America treading water, just to recover from the those 5 weeks. And I think even today, America has never recovered from those 5 weeks of that CDC botched. CDC should never, ever be in the testing business, ever. They should shut that unit down, because this is not the first time. And that was a catastrophic failure, and no one was fired because of it. And that demonstrates what we're dealing with. We're dealing with failed public health agencies, public health decisions and policies, yet no one is held accountable. So it goes on and on. So yesterday you're looking at all of the news stations, including CNN, which surprised me, and they're all questioning Walensky, Dr. Walensky. I have no... let's say, ill will or anything. I don't know this person, and I assume this person is a qualified person technically, but from in this position, she spent 1 year basically reversing everything that she says at a certain point. So it's almost as though the people who are feeding the information, because these organizations work in a way where the head of the organization really is not doing the data analysis and the number crunching. They depend a lot on all of the people that report up to them at higher levels as it goes up the chain. It seems that these people are not serving her well and misinforming her. Plus, she's a very political person too. So we have a situation where the country is being ill-served by public health agencies. They call them these alphabet agencies, CDC, NIH, FDA. And I agree. A lot of the people there should be fired, top down. And I think that was one of the greatest mistakes. My opinion, I like to speak what I think. I think that was one of them. Supported him a lot, tremendously. I thought he did very good things. But that was one of the greatest failures of President Trump. Didn't fire these people and use whatever means he had to fire them. Period.
Can I ask you a question, Dr. Alexander? I think you and I both agree there's been failures on all fronts around this pandemic by our federal health agencies. Is there anything you think they got right?
Nothing.
No.
I'll be honest with you.
No.
The thing is, it pains me to say it, but as a public health person or somebody, epidemiologist, whatever, and you look at every, because remember, Dr. Harris, from the beginning, when I came, as this began, I said, no, hold on, and I was, Scott Adams joined the administration around August, but I was there for me, and I was discussing things with it, and similar to the likes of Kuldorf and Bhattacharya and these people, we were saying a simple thing. Because when we began the lockdown in the mid of March of 2020, the data began to come in quickly to the United States. And you could see from the data, and you could see from what was being published, that COVID was amenable to risk stratification. And we understood very quickly that baseline risk pretty much predicted your course in COVID. And we understood that 95% of people, just without looking closely at the data, were basically not at severe risk from COVID. They would be able to handle this matter. And we recognized that an age risk stratified approach was the optimal and maybe the only way we should have gone forward, where we saw in the data there's a 1,000-fold difference in risk between an elderly person and a child for death. So then the question became, why would you have these carte blanche lockdowns? And the data was coming in about 2 weeks that the lockdowns were having a catastrophic effect in terms of the businesses right away, the business owners, the employees, and actually children. So we began to say, all we need really, and it's because of how we operated prior pandemics for 100 years. Remember, in the Athenian plague, which was, I think, 400 BC, so that's about 2,500 years ago, we have very ancient script that describes that it was the people who recovered from that plague were taking care of the sick. So we began to understand even back then what natural immunity was, recovered immunity, and how you operate in a situation. And they even have very rudimentary explanations of how they took care of the high-risk people that they realized was the elderly people. So we were saying, you strongly and properly protect the vulnerable in society first and only. If it's the only thing you can do, and you need to figure out what that means, because that doesn't mean that the government comes and put a heavy stamp on it. Because you have elderly in your own home. You have to be able to know. It is your responsibility to take care of your parents or your grandparents that live in your home. Make sure if there's a bad pathogen outside, make sure that Johnny doesn't just run into the room and hug up Granny and expose Granny. So Granny gonna have to spend a little more time in the house, maybe in the back room. You make sure Granny gets her food in a separate area, blah, blah, blah. You take steps to strongly protect the elderly in the nursing home, similar. And if that was all we could have done, we'd have not been in this situation, in this pandemic. But we also said, whilst you strongly protect the elderly, you make early treatment available to Granny in the nursing home. So that if Granny gets infected, if the infection breaches the nursing home, you offer Granny treatment so that she would recover, clear the infection, and she will get natural immunity. She does not have to go to the hospital, because once you enter the hospital, from the modeling, your 28-day mortality goes up to by about 40%. So we knew the key was to keep Granny out of the hospital. And I know this is your area, early treatment too, so you know what I'm talking about. So we said, strongly protect the elderly in the nursing home, offer early treatment, and whilst doing that, have some PSAs on vitamin D, the importance of supplementation, and the importance of getting your body weight under control. Lose 10, 15, 20 pounds. It's very important because obesity emerges as a superloaded risk factor early in the data. But above all, you let the rest of society, the low-risk healthy people in society, live free, largely unfettered lives, making reasonable safety precautions, living as near normal. Of course, it would never be as normal when you're in a crisis, even when you're living free, because you need to make some decisions. You know, I want to go and visit my grandmother today, but maybe I will not. Things like that. You know, maybe I might use a mask, even though these people saying the mask not really effective. You know what I mean? Out of respect, etc. And whatever very modest benefit it may or may not have. So that is all we were saying. Protect the elderly. Let the rest of society live normally. And what would have happened? We'd have gotten to the population level of herd immunity. But by locking us down for so long and then hardening the lockdown with each extension, you made it even harder. You denied the population from inching closer to population immunity. What are you seeing now in Australia? You are seeing with Omicron. Australia has been flat, and now Omicron has come, because Omicron even appeared in the Antarctic, where no one was infected. So it's in the environment, it's in the world. So it will get where it needs. Very infectious, which you know. Now Australia is dealing with a massive surge in infections, and they will have deaths. Because the lockdowns, as we kept saying, only delays the inevitable. You should have allowed your population to develop natural immunity so that when this has happened now, your population could withstand this variant coming. And so it was just devastating failures by these people. And they will not, it's the hubris and the arrogance of these people like Dr. Fauci, and this is my opinion, this is not yours, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and these people, that it was their lockdowns. I'll be as blunt as I can. I wouldn't put this on Trump. It was Fauci and Birx's lockdowns and school closures that killed thousands of people. Thousands of people in America died because of the lockdowns. I'm not even talking about failure to use early treatment, because McCullough and Zelenko, and we've modeled it. We've shown that maybe 80-85%, so maybe 750,000 people would be alive today had we used early treatment. And listen to me, I have used it. I've seen how it works in even my own family, my own friends, people who were at risk, so they were elderly, etc. They got COVID. They started symptoms. Those who used the early treatment survived, and those who did not passed. And it is clear, it was shockingly clear. You know, like, you've been espousing something and you say, well, how does this, you know, I need to see it really, really work, etc. And yes, I've seen how it works. And the antivirals do make a tremendous effect once you apply it early in the course. And it makes sense, because it's an antiviral and this is a virus. and you want to deal with it in the viral replication field. But I know I'm speaking to converted in you, so I'll stop.
All right, now, Dr. Paul Alexander, natural immunity is what we're trying to preach, nonstop and early treatment. Stay out of the hospitals. These are dangerous. We shouldn't be locking down things. This is destroying lives, livelihoods. The emotional impact is tremendous. We've got about 3 minutes left in this segment, and I want you to just answer yes or no to this, or a very short answer if you'd like. For the first time in my life as an adult or as a clinician of any kind, I am a chiropractor. I am not an epidemiologist of any kind. So I'm going to rely on you to be the expert in this field, not me. However, I want to know from an epidemiologist background, does this make sense to you? Or does this like shock you? For example, October 26th, the FDA published a document and then actually extended the emergency use authorization to children ages 5 to 11 for the Pfizer shots. I want to ask you something. In that document, it said from August of 2021 up until October 26th, of 2021, when they pushed this shot on everybody, 5 to 11, they actually blamed 40% of all new cases from August to October of COVID-19. They blamed it on the asymptomatic children in the United States. As an epidemiologist, does that make sense to you? Is this something we should believe? Is it true asymptomatic people are spreading this infection?
Well, no, and that's an example of what flies in the face of all of we know. First of all, let's just separate it out. During that period that you're talking about, Omicron was not even here. Omicron is highly infectious, much more than Delta. That period you just mentioned, Delta was predominant, 99% with Delta. What we know in basic immunology and virology, I am not an immunologist, but what I know enough, and I've studied enough now over these last 2 years, like people like McCullough, like yourself, we know more now. Asymptomatic transmission, how should I say it? Virus spreads, if you're symptomatic, you have to have symptoms for you to transmit to someone else. And that is how it operates. Yes, that's how it operates with all pathogens. And for the first time, they've changed the rules on COVID.
Thank God. Okay, that's what I wanted your answer to be. Now, I'm just going to read this real quick. We only got 50 seconds. On the FDA.gov's website right now, I want you to just real quickly answer this for my audience. On FDA.gov this morning, it says, do COVID-19 tests check for the Omicron, Delta, and other variants? And it says, currently, COVID-19 tests are designed and authorized to check broadly for the SARS-CoV-2 virus and not for specific variants, sometimes called mutations or genetic mutations. How do we know there's these Omicron Delta variants? Can we trust this stuff that's being perpetuated in the media when the FDA says there's no test for it? We got 15 seconds.
I don't think we could trust that, because I don't think we could trust anything that we've heard and we've dealt with for the last 2 years regarding this, any of the testing, because most of it, particularly the PCR, turned out to be false positives. We were locking down and isolating people when they were not positive because they overcycled these tests. So everything right now is, I would say, actually questionable and false to me.
Dr. Paul Alexander, thank you for coming on the show. We're out of time for this segment. I want you to know how grateful I am for all that you're doing and everything that you're publishing, even with the censorship that is occurring. I'm Dr. Artis. If you would like to continue to support me and support what we're trying to do in this movement, please support us at thedrartistshow.com. Go to the shop button, buy something, help support us. Use the Peter10 code so I can actually give some revenue share to Peter McCullough to help with his legal fees as people try to destroy his reputation and finances. They're not doing it with just him. They're doing it with multiple ones, but I'm trying to stand for all of those. Dr. Paul Alexander, thank you very much. Where can you point audiences real quickly to where they can follow you and what work you're producing? Brownstone.org, is that the best reference or somewhere else?
Brownstone.org, and also right now I'm writing my Substack, and the Substack is Alexander COVID News. So that's A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R, COVID News.
Alexander COVID News. Thank you very much, Dr. Paul Alexander. I hope to see you in Texas soon, buddy.